Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
So we've just had the results of the general election in the UK, the 2015 general election, and we just wanted to put out a bit of a reaction to it, really, and we needed a day or two to get over the result and to sort of absorb it, and we kind of just want to provide our take on what we think the result means for the UK. So as many will know, perhaps if you're abroad and not in Britain, you may not know the result, but the Conservatives, the Blues, or the Tories, as they're also known, they won, and they didn't just win, but it was actually quite a landslide, really, which I think took a lot of people by surprise. Peter, were you pretty surprised by that?
Possibly. I mean, I tend to have a more on-the-ground view of this, so I wasn't really maybe thinking what would happen, but I actually went to the count in Brighton for Brighton Hove and Brighton Kemp Town. So the two seats in Brighton, Brighton Pavilion and Brighton Kemp Town and Hove, so about the three seats, and they were counting the votes. So I really was sort of there seeing things actually being counted. So I was literally seeing the actual votes in the ballot boxes and stuff coming out. And I mean, you start getting to really early in the morning and standing around for 6 or 7 hours, you're collapsing at the end of it. It's a bit hard to always quite know if the sun's come up or not, or quite what is going on. I did hear the exit poll before I left. I actually left here at midnight to go down. It was open from 11, but I didn't want to get there that early. So it was open from 10, but it wasn't worth going there before about 11.
Nothing really starts happening, does it?
The ballots have to be taken there. Boxes have to be taken there. So, I left at midnight, and I got there about 12:30. And, but just as I left, there was the thing had come on the radio. I was partly wanting to listen to it on the radio as well to get an idea what was happening. And, that exit poll came out. And, it was a surprise. I've heard there were Labour supporters in a pub in Brighton who were about to go where I went to the count and were absolutely, stunned in silence just for a moment, shocked,
Well, it wasn't just... I think many were predicting a close call and a hung parliament as a result of a bit of a Labour-Conservative split. But the Conservatives, it wasn't just a win. It was quite a comfortable win, really. I think they ended up with a majority of around 20 or so seats, and I think they needed 327 or so to basically pass the post, because hence the name First Past the Post. That's the name of our system. And the exit poll, that was a strange one, because I wasn't at a count. I was just watching it at home, and when that exit poll hit, I was watching it on the BBC. All of the pundits pretty much dismissed the exit poll. They said, oh no, that's purely conjecture and it's pretty sensationalist. We don't expect the SNP to get 58 seats, and we certainly don't expect the Tories to win that comfortably. And I think the biggest shock and the thing that they wouldn't accept is the decimation of the Liberal Democrats from 50 odd members of parliament down to about, I think the exit poll suggested 10. So the end result was even worse for the Lib Dems than the exit poll. And I mean, that was pretty shocking, but I guess that probably was a result of the fact they were in that coalition, which they've been in with the Tories since 2010. And I guess people kind of just lost all respect for Nick Clegg and some of the things he did, such as, I think he voted for the increase of tuition fees, for example. So
That's right. I mean, it's not wholly unexpected. A couple of weeks before that poll was actually a poll with that result did come out, but they suppressed it a bit because the pollsters apparently didn't believe it themselves.
I read that.
A bit of an anomaly,
Yeah.
But going back to 1992, when John Major won again against the odds, similar thing happened where no one expected it, and then he did. And at the time, I don't know about exactly at the time, but there was talk that it could have been a bit of a scam with some extra votes put into certain ballot boxes to make it swing over in marginal seats, which could be done. And there's an analysis been made of it, which I won't go into now. It's a bit too fiddly to explain over a phone. But Yeah, that could have been done in the major election. There's no real proof, but it's a possible thing that could have happened. I don't know in this case. I haven't looked at it in a sufficient detail. But, you know, I don't think there's any particular theories of it being a fraudulent election. But certainly, you know, all these things, the S&P did seem to create some sort of fear that maybe they were going to hold the balance of power. And I think that maybe has had an effect. But yeah. The real problem is how disproportionate the result is to the vote actually cast. I mean, exactly. I don't know if you've seen any of the things in the paper and online showing how it would break down if it was proportionate. And if it had been, I think UKIP would have had, you know, quite a few MPs, 40 or 50 MPs, and same with Lib Dems. And I haven't got the figures to hand, but
yeah, they'd apparently, if
Greens would have had 24.
Yeah,
you know,
apparently if we, because we have a first past the post system, which I've read is a bit of a, it's a bit of an old, archaic, historical concept, and it's not really relevant for modern politics in the UK, because we apparently it was originally set up when there was very much a two-party system, and we definitely don't have a two-party system anymore. I mean, perhaps we did 10 years ago, maybe even the last election, 2010 one, but I think this year, this election, perhaps, arguably marks the beginning of a real need for proportional representation as an alternative to the old first-past-the-post system. Because, yeah, I think I read the statistic about UKIP, and they apparently got 12% of the vote, which was accounted for around 4 million people. Mm. And if we had a proportional representation system, that would mean that they'd now be the third largest party in Britain, and they would have for probably around 50 or so seats, maybe even more than that. So they've gone from that to what we have as a result of first past the post, which is one standing member of parliament, which, something just doesn't seem right there. And I mean, I guess, you know, say what you will about UKIP and their politics, but they obviously are proving relatively popular, but there's just no representation as a result of this system. And yeah, it seems flawed, and it doesn't seem right to me. It does seem like it needs reform.
Yeah, it does seem strange, and it's a shame, really, because they do put a lot of effort in, all the parties, and you don't have to agree with them all, but they've all got their points to make. And if they're in an alliance of, well, even an alliance or just in Parliament, the Tories still would have got in under a proportional system.
Yeah, but still
they
be the biggest,
would have had all
yeah.
these other parties that they would have had to have convinced if it was a close-run thing. They might have had to agree with some and disagree with others, and you know, it's like an abacus. You slide beads one way or the other to make a big pile on one side, and that's that gets it through. And if you slide them the other way, it goes the other way. And we did have a referendum about PR, which is proportional representation, a few years ago, and it got voted out. And the system they proposed was a quite confusing one. I can't even remember the name of it now, because there's quite a few different systems you can have. It's not one thing called proportional representation, unfortunately. It's a number of different systems. And the one they chose is one where you have to have a sort of, you write numbers on all the candidates. I think you write number one, say you wanted Tories, and you write number one, then you write two for Labour if they're your second choice, and so on. And then what happens is the last one in the ranking order gets, those votes get moved up to the next one if they don't get in, they drop off the list. It's very confusing, and no one really understood it, to be honest. I still don't really quite understand it. And
yeah, I vaguely remember that now, that referendum.
Yeah, I voted no because it was a stupid system, and I prefer a proportional system, but what they came up with was confusing, and a lot of people can't even understand the ballot paper as it is. I mean, I've seen sport ballots. We were looking at all the sport ballots on Thursday night and on Saturday. We had local elections as well. So I was at the Thursday one from just after midnight to 6 in the morning, and they didn't even announce the results then. I went home, I was too tired, and some friends of mine did stick it out to about 9 o'clock in the morning when they finally got the results.
Right.
Which, well, last time I did, it was 8 a.m. So it was ridiculous last time, but this time it was just as bad. But we did have two elections at the same time, and they had two lots of ballot boxes. So, and they opened them all up on the same evening, which slowed things down a bit. because you have to validate the vote. There's so many stages in how votes are counted. It's not simple. They take them all out, then they validate them, which means you go through and you work out, do they tally up with the numbers at the polling station that have been claimed to have been cast? Because when you get a vote, they tear it off a pad and there's a bit left over, a stub. And they have to compare all those, I believe, to check they've got them all. And then they have to bundle them all up into batches of 25, which takes a while. And then they go through ones that are doubtful, called doubtful votes. And these are the ones that you think of as spoil or just confusingly made, even though it's very simple to put an X. Or if it's a local election, you might have three votes for different candidates, different councillors. But, you know, the public, you know, they still do funny things. Some of them just put, you know, two X's on when it's meant to be one on the general. Or they write numbers on it. I mean, the things I actually saw, somebody coloured one in with felt tips, all different colours. I mean, that was bonkers.
That's bizarre.
You know, that was just silly. Some of them are postal votes, and that they can spend ages messing around with the ballot paper if they want, because they get sent the same ballot paper. It doesn't look any different.
Yeah.
Quite a lot, you know, they have, too many X's, or someone rubs one out, and then they do it again. And, you know, it's down to returning officers, policy. And what our returning officer said was she wanted to allow the voter's intention to be clear, so it didn't have to be properly done as long as it was clear.
Yeah.
So some of them were ticked or they had too many crosses on. But there was one a bit controversial where they had, in the council election, it was meant to be two candidates in a ward, and there were three crosses on it, but two of the crosses were big and one was tiny. So she said, well, I'll allow that for, you know, the Tories, as it was. And another person was arguing, saying that shouldn't be allowed. And then they had to go back and dig out all the other ones that had been done the same and changed the result to match. So it was the same for everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as it's the same for everybody, so it's kind of all right.
It's weird, though, because it's interesting about this, because one thing that I suddenly thought was, well, that's all very well if that's the consensus in one constituency, in one polling booth, but what about the fact that perhaps some other manager or overseer of a polling booth in a different area of the country has a different perspective on that and has a different view?
Well, the public tend to be equally dumb, whatever party they're voting for, perhaps, but you might expect Conservatives to be a bit more establishment, so they'll probably always put the X in the right place.
Yeah.
So it could disfavour those who might be less literate, perhaps.
Sure.
But it doesn't apply to the general election, that principle. It's only really local elections, but because we had both on the same day, which was confusing. So they counted the general on Thursday and the other one on Saturday, and that was very long. That took about 10 hours. I got there at 10 o'clock. It opened at 9 in the morning. Yep. Didn't get out to 7 o'clock in the evening.
Wow.
And once you're in there, you're not allowed to go out, in fact. Well, actually, no, that used to be the case. In fact, now they do let you out because smokers tend to come out quite a lot. But you're not allowed to, you can't, and from either election, you're not allowed to tweet out or Facebook out or anything to tell the results. You know, it's criminal offence.
Yeah.
It has to be announced by the returning officer on the stage. That's the first time it must be known to anyone. So it's quite interesting to be there and see it all being done and be involved as well. It's well worth doing it. It's very interesting if you ever get a chance, and you can get paid to count the votes. Actually, I wasn't doing that. I was with one of the parties helping them validate votes, you know, checking these odd ballots that looked a bit iffy, but so that wasn't paid, but it was interesting. I'm seeing it from kind of snail's eye point of view, really. You know, I wasn't able to see much coverage. I saw a little bit. There were some TV screens around, but didn't get a chance to look at them really very much.
No, well, obviously the focus was on the Brighton one where you were.
But
I mean, would you say you, as a result of being there, I mean, you have faith in the system, in the actual way it's done? It's an accurate count. There's no chance of inaccuracy or foul play from what you've seen.
There are lots of things you could do. I think if it's run honestly, it's fine, but it does have to be run honestly. I thought the returning officer we have is exceptionally good, so I was impressed by that.
Yeah.
But if someone crooked was running it, you could see plenty of times when, you know. One awkward thing, they took all the local election ones out of the ballot boxes to validate them. Then they put them all back in the ballot boxes again and locked them up for for Friday and didn't get them out for Saturday morning. So you might think if you really wanted it secure, you'd probably not take them out at all.
Yeah.
But they tried to validate both lots at once, which slowed it down a lot on the Thursday and probably was a bit unnecessary, may have been a mistake. But it was a real anomaly because the locals were every 4 years and the general is now every five. That didn't used to be the case, but it was an anomaly. But they both fell on the same day. It apparently won't happen for another 20 years unless they change the system. Yeah.
Okay. So, interesting.
Yeah, it's a strange way of having it.
So it's.
But yeah, if we get the Europe referendum, that'd be the next one.
Well,
I think.
Yeah, that's. I mean that. So I mean, so now we've got the Conservatives in. Then we have an EU referendum. They've promised an EU referendum vote, and that, but no, I don't think they've said when that will be. But don't think it. I remember reading it was 2017. I'm not sure where I got that from. So it's not around the corner. It is still a while away.
Well, politically, it's quite around the corner. If you think of 5 years of a parliament, it's 18 months.
Yeah,
and look how long that Scottish thing went on for.
It's just it's interesting, just because I mean, one of some of our previous episodes, we were at an event. There were some speakers, Democracy in Danger, and I think on many, probably on more than one occasion, it was mentioned that the EU is soon going to pass some sort of regulation that is enforceable. It's not a directive. There's a distinction in EU law between a directive and a regulation. The regulation is like the law, and every state must abide by it, essentially. But they're essentially changing the system, so it's going to become much harder for a member state to actually get out of the European Union, and they need some big consensus. There needs to be a vote, and all the states essentially have to agree that state can leave. So it just sounds like it's going to be tougher acts to get out of the EU if we actually do vote to get out. I mean, personally, I get the impression that most people in Britain would still vote to stay in the EU, perhaps out of ignorance of what the EU represents and what's going on. But I think the mainstream media, they seem to be generally pro-EU, and there seems to be a general sense that it's the radical stance to be anti-EU and to say that the UK should pull out. But who knows what's going to happen in the next couple of years. There could be many events that unfold that sort of sway public opinion.
Yeah, I think making predictions about any of these things seems to be a fallacy. I mean, when we had that talk with Ray Sheaf just a few weeks ago, he was telling us it's going to be a kind of meltdown after the election, and now that's completely settled, there's a stable government, albeit one we might not like.
Pretty stable, very stable government, yeah. Kind of classic conservative government.
Yeah, actually it's not that big a majority though, to be fair, and although it's a majority government, there have been bigger ones in the past, and but it's hard to see where the opposition will come from with a Labour Party that's rather been broken at the moment. It's going to take a long time to rebuild that.
They really need a solid, strong leader to step forward, and I don't personally. I don't see anyone out there.
I don't think the next leader they have will be the one that fights the next election. They probably need an interim leader just to build it up a bit, and then get someone in who's got a bit of clout.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, Ed Miliband's. I have my doubts about Ed Miliband, but he was actually growing on me as a person, and I was starting to gain some respect for him. And it's always important. People, I think, tend to forget, but in 2013, which obviously wasn't very long ago at all, we almost went to war with Syria, and we almost went to war against the Assad regime. So we would have essentially been fighting alongside what is now ISIS. And the only reason that was stopped was because, if I remember right, David Cameron was for it, but he wanted to have a parliamentary vote. He didn't want to do a repeat of what Tony Blair did. And Ed Miliband stepped in and forced and voted against it, and the majority of Labour MPs voted against it. So it's sort of basically the Parliament forced David Cameron's hand, and if I remember right, that forced Barack Obama to essentially back down from going to war against Syria, because Britain wouldn't have been fighting alongside the US, and I think Obama would have taken too much of a hit politically if he'd have tried to go forward with it. So Ed Miliband was quite instrumental during that whole period. And I rewatched the parliamentary debate on YouTube about a couple of days back, I think just before the election, actually, because I just wanted to remind myself of that whole incident. And it is very much the case that Ed Miliband pretty much did, personally, I think, unless there was more to it, he pretty much single-handedly prevented us from going to war against Syria there, because otherwise I think most of the Conservatives and the Lib Dems were for it. So he did do a lot of good stuff, Miliband, but I just think perhaps his personality just didn't come across very well. He wasn't very media savvy, and he came across just awkwardly, I think, unfortunately. But he was trying to improve his image, but unfortunately I just don't think he managed to quite do enough. And there was also that fear, I think, people had that the SNP, they were going to do a deal with the SNP, and then we would have the Scottish National Party kind of with more sway than they should really have in England, in Westminster. So there was all that going on. And I guess all these things probably contributed towards people thinking, no, we need a stable economy, and Cameron seems to be doing a good job of boosting the UK's economy and putting us back on track in terms of being on the world stage as a major economy and all this business.
Yeah.
But for the people who are at the lower end of the spectrum and the poorer people out there, it's definitely not a good result at all. I mean, Russell Brand was saying on his YouTube channel that this has pretty much convinced him that politics isn't the way forward. He seems pretty disillusioned by politics as a result of this election. And I mean, I don't agree with a lot of what Russell Brand says, if I'm honest, but I think he's a thoroughly decent guy and he's got a lot of integrity. And it's interesting that he's pretty much saying, well, this pretty much proves that as it currently stands, grassroots movements online and all this kind of thing, they don't seem to sway the old school sort of majority of people out there, the kind of older generations, etc., the kind of the real voters, the ones that are always going to make the effort to go out and vote every time there's an election. They're always going to vote for the same, you know, they're always going to vote for Conservative. And certainly in the UK, it's just a numbers game, really. We can have this massive movement that wants change and wants there to be this radical overhaul of the system, but we still don't have critical mass. So as a result, the Conservatives, it's the same old perpetual cycle. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we may see that change in the next election, perhaps in the next one. There will be that tipping point of people.
Well, there was, you know, when Blair came in, but it might be argued he went too far to make it like Conservatives, but it probably wasn't as bad as the Conservatives would have been if you're opposed to that worldview. Some may not be who are listening. You know, we shouldn't assume everyone is left-wing, or I'm not sure we are necessarily. But if we look at it just as a scenario, yeah, the Conservative view does tend to be the propertied middle classes, upper middle classes even, and they tend to be, you know, because they haven't got any particular threats apart from if they're suddenly given mansion taxes and things like that, which tends to be a bit off-putting. But they don't have any immediate threats to their situation, whereas if you're living on a minimum wage or contracts in employment, not very shaky, or the housing situation is particularly pressing in Britain, then yeah, the idea of making tenancies longer and things like that were put over by Labour. They were good ideas. I can't see Conservatives be that worried about that sort of thing. They may do it because they may realise they still need things to be a bit more stable. I mean, the Conservative candidate in Brighton Pavilion, Clarence Mitchell, he did say he supported having longer tenancies and stuff. Maybe he will, but I don't know if it's their policy, because of course they can say what they like. Some of the individual candidates, they may agree with things, but you know, they can put forward bills, but they don't always get anywhere. They get talked out, your private members' bills. I mean, that happened recently on a subject like that. So they're not all evil. I mean, a lot of good people in the Conservative Party, I'm sure, but they don't all have huge power themselves because they're within that machine as well. They may try to do something that's a bit better. Some are more unpleasant, and the ones that talk out bills are particularly unpleasant, I think, so just don't let anyone have a say. You could just keep talking. You can read the telephone directory out, apparently, and it doesn't matter as long as you keep going. And you could just fill the time and literally stop someone discussing something in certain debates, which is a very archaic rule. And I think some of the rules need to be changed about how House of Commons runs, if you're going to have a House of Commons at all. You know, the Scottish Parliament's probably got some lessons to teach us there. It's much more about, you know, we have all this booing and shouting and, you know, it's funny to listen to, but actually doesn't really achieve very much. I think it's time maybe it's got to an end. Maybe not get rid of all the colour, but, you know, maybe just have a bit more sensibility in the way it's run, I think. Because it just doesn't help anyone get points over.
No, absolutely. I mean, whenever I watch parliamentary questions, I end up just feeling like I've watched a stage play. It's just pre-written speeches and lots of acting, and it's an entertaining display. It's really quite comical, actually, but I don't really get the impression that it's democracy in action, really. It just seems a little bit pre-planned, and it isn't really a debate. It's just kind of everyone just follows the rules, and the kind of politicians who are a bit outspoken, I mean, they seem to be disappearing off the face of the map now, and this election seems to have really carved the way for that. I mean, I don't know necessarily if I agree with all of his politics, but George Galloway is an example of that. He's now had to, well, he's no longer a member of parliament for Bradford West, so you won't see him anymore giving his dissenting...
I think we'll see George Galloway somewhere.
Well, we won't see him in Parliament, though. I mean, we won't see him giving his amazing...
You've heard that before, though.
Yeah, sure, but I'm talking about the next 5 years.
He might stand in by-election. He's challenging the result, apparently, but I don't know much about that.
I think he's challenging the result because he doesn't think that the Labour MP, the MP, I can't remember their name, but I think he feels there was a bit of an unfair game being played there, and there was some underhand tactics going on.
I don't know about it in detail, no, but he has been voted out before and may come back, so
he was talking about standing for the Mayor of London.
He might
seems to be his next idea.
Yeah,
but Galloway was a dissenting voice that was always very entertaining in Parliament, and for the time being, at least, we're not going to have people like Galloway around.
We've got Carolyn Lucas back in, I mean, that's good. I know we may not agree with everything she says about the climate change stuff, maybe, but she does a lot of good things. I mean, I'd have voted for her if I was in that constituency, which I'm not. I'm over the border from her, but I would have voted for her. I'm sure there are some good ones in there. I mean, there's still 8 Lib Dems, which is still a little group that can put different ideas in. That's still 8 times what the Greens have got. It's not enough to hold the balance of power, but it's still a little group in there that can put things forward. If they become a bit more true to their ideas as they were before, you know, they just got a bit too close to the boss, as they say. It's a phrase, getting sick with the boss.
I don't think anyone knows what the Liberal Democrats represent. That's the problem. I mean, if you asked me what do they represent, I wouldn't know. I don't know what the distinction is between a Liberal Democrat and a Tory.
There's quite a lot. I've been to Liberal Democrat conferences a few times when they used to be in Brighton. Yeah, I mean, it's a different episode to really talk about that in depth.
I think I'm confident in saying that would be the general consensus. Certainly, people of a younger generation. No one knows what the Liberal Democrats represent.
Yeah, I think recently they've let themselves down because the problem is they have gone against things that they might have engendered. And by doing that, they may have done it for pragmatic reasons. And to be brutally honest, it's a fair thing to say. The Liberal Democrats probably did a lot of good in the last government, because without them, it probably would have been a lot worse. But that's not very good when it's still very bad, you know. And that's the trouble. You don't see the worst thing you would have had if you hadn't had them there, you know.
No, Nick Clegg was in a very difficult position. And I think his speech when he resigned, it was a very powerful speech. And I think it was the sort of speech he should have given a long time ago, because I think people realised he's a human being and he's got passion about what he does. But he's a good bloke, Nick Clegg, absolutely. And I mean, so is the previous Lib Dems, like, what's his name, Charles Kennedy and Paddy Ashdown and all them.
Yeah, they've had some good ones, didn't they, you know.
But it's just unfortunate, they were in a very difficult situation 5 years ago and they've been punished for it. I mean, hopefully they will come back.
They've been up and down before, you know, and they've probably never got quite this big before. We did a Lib Lab Pact, hard to say, in the 70s. I can't remember much about that. That was that 1975. So they were in power before, and before that, I think it was Gladstone going way, way back.
Yeah.
So so they've had their moments, but yeah, they may have to wait a little bit for another one. What would you say about you, Kip? I mean, Nigel Farage today is now apparently still going to be the leader, which is good.
Yeah, so he stood down, and then apparently they've rejected his request to stand down. So they want him so badly to be the leader of UKIP.
Yeah.
And he's accepted that, so he's on track to remain the leader.
That's good. I hope he has a bit of a break, though, over the summer.
Yeah, I think so. I think he will. I mean, I think UKIP, I mean, I generally think that they've got some very interesting views about things, and what annoys me about UKIP is that there seems to have been a real attempt to kind of assassinate Nigel Farage's character by the mainstream media, and there's a very aggressive militant leftist sort of grouping out there in Britain, and I think the BBC perhaps represent that to a certain aspect. I mean, going back to the Question Time episode when they were all interviewed, and there seemed to be this sort of renter mob in there that were just anti-UKIP and anti...
Oh, yeah, yeah, but, in the audience.
Yeah, in the audience. But they're just basically, I mean, certainly from my perspective, people I speak to and the kind of social circles I hang around with, everyone seems to think that UKIP are kind of this aggressive, right-wing, almost fascist-like party, which seems to be the result of a smearing campaign by the media. And it seems to... Yeah. I mean, even though it seems to have been quite effective, UKIP still ended up doing extremely well during this election.
As a number of votes, they did very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And one interesting thing Farage said, and I don't know if it's true or not, I mean, I guess he must have some evidence to back it up, but he was saying that they've realised that there's a massive amount of voters who are sort of in their 20s who are voting UKIP and supporting UKIP, so there's a much younger vote coming forward for UKIP. So I don't know what that's about. I mean, perhaps there are people out there who are getting quite savvy and getting quite aware of alternative news and media and think that actually, you know what, some of what UKIP have to say is pretty spot on.
Maybe. I didn't see it myself. I mean, I know the Brighton UKIP, and I was with them during the election, helping them out. I didn't vote for them, actually, because they didn't stand in my area anyway, but tactically I wouldn't have done because it was better for me to vote Labour. But they're a nice bunch. They weren't very young, I have to say, so I didn't see any evidence of that from what I saw, but I'm sure other places it may be true.
Well, this is what Farage said.
The council, again, they got quite a good share of the vote. They beat the Lib Dems in several wards and occasionally beat the Greens, but they didn't get any councillors, unfortunately. They did have, they lost. Which
I think they consistently came third certainly when I was watching the results coming in nationally, they were consistently third. So they were beating everyone except.
Yeah, it's good if you do that because you're not coming bottom. It's quite, you know, some of the parties they beat were, you know, like Lib Dems have been major parties in the past. So it takes a lot to come from nowhere, but it's not much of a victory when you do all that just to get one MP.
No, it's
heartbreaking really for anybody.
I'm going to be honest. I personally was disappointed with the Fannett result and the fact Farage didn't get in as an MP.
Because he did get a good number of votes.
He got a good number of votes, but that, I think what happened in Fannett was a bit of a disgrace, personally, because apparently the Conservatives ploughed a hell of a lot of money into that area because they were determined to ensure Nigel Farage didn't get voted in. So they heavily canvassed that area. So they really put the Conservative guy on the map, who, funnily enough, was an ex-UKIP guy. So it was an ex-UKIP guy standing against Farage. I don't know why the guy left UKIP, but that was something I can't remember his name now. And then there was a bit of a farce because you had that Al Murray guy, the comedian, pub landlord guy, who I mean, I don't necessarily have anything against what he did. I think it was a bit of a publicity stunt, really. But I don't understand why the guy was so against Farage. And again, I think it all goes back to this kind of aggressive leftist movement.
Yeah, I think he's a sort of left-wing comedian who is probably actually quite well off and kind of comes from a middle-class background, making fun of the working classes a bit.
Yeah.
That's what I understand. He got a very poor vote anyway.
Well, I think people saw right through it. I think it was just silly. I mean, it didn't affect Farage, but it just, to me, it represented the kind of a prime example of what I'm talking about with this. It seems to be this public smearing campaign going on against UKIP, and they seem hell bent and desperate to kind of paint them as this sort of evil force that nobody should vote for. And it's a shame, because I just think, well, actually, when you look at their policies, I mean, the only thing that I would be against, I would personally say, is well, two things really. Their stance on the NHS, I don't necessarily agree with, because they're kind of looking to privatise it, really. But also,
I think that's been changed. No, there was a policy, they changed that.
They've reversed that, have they?
Yeah, they've reversed that. Yeah.
But in the fracking as well, it's a shame that they're pro fracking.
Yeah, that's probably a mistake.
Yeah.
But then all the other parties are pro fracking. You see, Conservative parties are pro fracking, so no one ever goes with them.
Yeah, but the Greens aren't, though, are they?
No, they're not. But they're quite small. Whereas Labour probably are pro fracking, as long as we do it carefully and we've got to ask all the questions, health and safety, etc., they'll give you a nice answer.
Yeah.
But in all reality, they're probably for it. So again, why are they not getting the flak? Why does the UKIP get the flak?
Yeah.
When that's only one of their policies out of many, you know. This is the trouble. It's like they say, when UKIP does something wrong, no one forgets, but they forget all the loony Tories who come out with just as bad stuff, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And it tends to get thrown at UKIP, because really I think it's best in the interest to put them down, because they really are a threat to the system, because their idea is different about the European thing. All the others kind of go along with that to some degree anyway. I think they all do now.
Yeah.
In fact, they just want to give you a referendum. The Tories kind of want to have a referendum. Some of the Tories would be like UKIP. Well, look, but
Cameron seems to be suggesting that he's going to get tough on the EU, and hopefully that's going to happen. And he seems to be saying he's going to have no compromises with them. He's going to say, this is what we want, and if we don't get it, then we're probably going to get out of the EU, or something essentially along those lines.
Yeah.
So maybe this will happen. Who knows? I guess the other elephant in the living room is this whole TTIP agreement, Transatlantic Trade Partnership.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Trade Investment Partnership.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a really scary bit of legislation, and not enough people know about this at all. And there's just been this absolute blanket kind of, well, just silence about this in the mainstream media. And I don't know if UKIP are pro-TTIP. I think somebody at that Democracy in Danger event we went to seemed to
There was someone who thought they were, and I said they're not.
They're not, okay.
They're anti-TTIP.
I remember you saying now, yeah, okay.
If you Google it, just put UKIP TTIP into YouTube and you'll find a bit. With their press officer, I think, says they're against it at a conference, so it's good enough for me.
Yeah, no, that's good enough for me. Yeah, I didn't realise, but I didn't think they would be. I just wasn't sure. But
you're going to get, you know, there's all sorts of silly disinformation flying around about everything in elections. You know, you've got to really go back and find who's really said what.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's getting misreported.
But this seems to have a lot of sway at the moment, and certainly that the debates at the planning phases we're apparently at with TTIP, and there's a lot of behind the scenes negotiations going on, and we're not privy to them at all, and they're between the EU and the US essentially. I think the UK is sort of involved, but it's more sort of Brussels US type kind of arrangement going on. I mean, I don't know a great deal about it, but from what I understand of it, it basically just gives corporations permission to sue governments if they feel that their own sovereign laws are somehow acting as a blocker for the corporations to make a profit. So, for example, if the UK were suddenly adamantly against fracking, a big US energy company could come into the UK and say, well, you know what, this is affecting our ability to make a profit, so we're going to sue you. And that's how I read TTIP. And, yeah, it's terrifying. And the Conservatives are pro-TTIP. They're completely pro-TTIP. I mean, Boris Johnson wrote an article in The Independent saying that anyone who, you know, basically Churchill would be pro TTIP, and he was kind of playing on the whole VE Day celebration thing, trying to promote TTIP, saying, I think he called it Churchillian. He said it was this fantastic Anglo-American trade arrangement that was going to basically promote business and make everyone rich. But I don't know, it seemed quite sinister to me. Seems like it's the end of sovereignty, really. Seems like corporations are finally going to take over.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real deal. I mean, obviously, we talk about New World Order and stuff, but we mustn't forget that behind all this politics is yeah, the covert stuff going on, which is probably the real story, really.
Yeah.
And but yeah, there was a demo about TTIP in Brighton a couple of weeks ago. But there's on the 31st of May in Lewis, I think there's a whole, I don't know if it's a day or if it's just the evening, I'm not sure, but there's a thing there in a community centre about TTIP, some speakers talking about it, I think a film and a social afterwards, that might be worth going to. I think it's at the All Saints Centre in Lewis.
Okay.
Yeah, I hope to go along, well, maybe you could, I don't know, record some stuff. But that'd be a good place to find out. You know, if we got some bits of audio from that, we could learn more about it and put it out on the information.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a hustings meeting about TTIP during the election campaign we could have gone to, but it clashed with one of those Democracy in Danger events, so we couldn't go to that. But I do know the local UKIP were at it, and they said they were against it, so that's something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to believe what goes around from somebody's second... second party, is that the phrase? That kind of
first hand
party rumours,
yeah,
you know, that aren't always true.
Yeah.
You need to go back and check what someone's actually said themselves, because to say the left, yeah, in terms of the hard left, there's a lot of kind of left-wing parties who did very bad, Left Unity and Tusk, a trade union, Socialist Coalition. And you can always tell these things are kind of foul. The more things have got on them, so they're united and coalitions and things like that, it generally means they're even smaller than that.
Yeah.
You know, two guys in a pub, you know, and they did very badly. Well, I think they may have meant well at some level, but they just split the left-wing vote as usual, and nothing's achieved. They lose a deposit, and so what? You know. So, yeah. And they're the ones often throwing the nasty stuff at UKIP and others and saying, you know, you're this, that and the other. But then they get really bad results, and that's all they are.
Yeah,
so they'd be better off having a pressure group to do that rather than having a political party, because often parties aren't, even for UKIP really, I mean, it's not ideal even being a party, because once the referendums happen, what are they going to call themselves then? You know, it could,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, they've got to rethink it.
They're essentially a one policy party, so it's not the solution at all. It's just they seem like the, I mean, arguably, they seem like the best of a bad bunch, really. But
yeah,
only if you're anti-EU. I mean, a lot of people aren't anti-EU. I mean, the thing about being anti-EU is I'm not 100% decided where I stand on when it comes to this debate. But I just think that Farage has put forward a lot of very convincing arguments with regards to our sovereignty,
yeah,
as a country and as any country in Europe, not just Britain, and we seem to be becoming, I mean, I remember when I did law at university, I did an EU law module, and one of the things I took away from doing that was that ultimately the debate about the European Union is about whether or not you believe that the EU is what's known as an intergovernmental organisation, or whether or not it's what's known as a supranational organisation, which, you know, is very academic,
yeah,
kind of wording, but essentially all it means is the EU just a bunch of government having a meeting and discussing policies and having a shared front that they broadcast to the world and basically get together and do trade? Or is it ultimately an attempt to become a super state like the United States of Europe? And it's not popular in academia to say that it's a supranational body, because that's not the general consensus. The consensus is no, it's just an intergovernmental thing, nothing to be scared of.
Yeah.
But actually, in my opinion, and certainly from what I'm seeing of what's happening, no, it's not. It's blatantly an attempt to create a super state, and it's a stepping stones approach, as David Icke would say. And we're just, every few years that passes by, we're losing more and more sovereignty. And I mean, some people seem to be pro that because they seem to be suggesting, oh, we shouldn't have barriers and we should all just be one world, or, you know what I mean? But I just don't think that that's necessarily the idea they've got. They've not got this utopian idea at heart. They seem to, it's more centralising power, and that I'm not convinced that's going to promote freedom at all. I think it's going to do the opposite, ultimately.
Yeah, it seems nice. I have no borders, but as Alex Jones says, borders are fire breaks, they're like fire doors against tyranny. You can,
yeah,
really stop it in a country if things go wrong. And you can still go between the countries. No one's physically putting a wall up. only when you had, you know, the North and South Korea, that happened, and then, you know, the Berlin Wall. But apart from ridiculous examples like that of extreme situations, in general, you know, you can go between the countries. Certainly in Europe you can anyway. You know, you need a visa to go to other places anyway, but that's the way the world is. But in terms of it, you know, living somewhere and moving there, well, you know, it's always happened anyway. I mean, it's happened before we were in the EU. I don't quite see what the big deal is, why it has to be accelerated, because it's always happened. Anyone who really wanted to move to Spain did so anyway.
Yeah, if you needed it bad enough. If you had if you had a good reason to go there, if you had the money to back you up or a business, you could do it.
Yeah.
But it has to be said, I mean, again, it's a controversial subject, but the other issue with the EU is just the levels of immigration we're receiving in the UK. They're just not sustainable, and there are many people that would probably argue that that's all over dramatic and oversimplifying the problem, and in fact there are as many people leaving as coming in, but I don't think that's the reality that personally I see on the ground. I just see an erosion of culture, and we're kind of becoming certainly a country in Britain, or certainly where we live in the UK, in Brighton, it's becoming very multicultural, which isn't a bad thing, but I just think we're not seeing enough integration. We're seeing too much segregated communities where we have one side of the road being from one area and doing their own thing, and another, someone at some other area doing something else, if that makes sense. And I don't know, I just feel that perhaps that's not really what we should be striving for. We should instead be trying to promote a common culture, and there doesn't seem to be that push. And that, to me, that's problematic, and it's worrying, because I just think perhaps in 10 or 20 years' time, we won't really have a shared culture anymore. We probably won't even have a shared language.
Yeah, you definitely need something running in parallel with what they've got if they're coming here to have, you know, different areas. That might be all right, but I think you need to have the common culture as well as an umbrella over that. Otherwise, it's going to lose direction at some point. And certainly, you know, in terms of the population level, I mean, yeah, you could build over every square yard if you wanted to, but in reality, if you want to have water and food and stuff, you know, you've got to have greenery and things as well, or it's going to be an awful dystopian kind of, you know, Robocop-style megacity, which you'd end up with. So yeah. If you've got a reasonable standards, you've got to have a balance of countryside and towns and stuff. You don't want to degrade the countryside with too many roads and trains and stuff. Yeah. Well, it just becomes completely horrible anyway, and you wonder why anyone would want to come here.
Well, yeah,
unless it's just exactly. About money. And if it's only about money, well, I don't think that's a very good reason to do it.
No.
And but certainly because of the housing, yeah, that's got so expensive. It's a good barometer for all these things. You can't afford a decent place, or it's so expensive. There's something wrong somewhere, whether it's immigration, or I don't think it's necessarily population level, because it's not really gone up that much. The problem seems to be just, a lot of it is just housing and flats being bought by offshore organisations and holding them as land banks, and there are whole blocks of flats in London are bought and left empty just so they accumulate a higher price and are going to be sold on later on. Things like that should be illegal.
Oh, it should be that should be absolutely outlawed. It's abhorrent, and you get apparently, I saw a documentary about this where you get sort of Chinese wealthy businessmen that will, like you say, buy up an entire block of flats in London, and they buy it on spec. They don't even come and see the place. They just buy it on spec. It's just outrageous. Yeah, I can't accept any argument that would be for that kind of scenario, because it just seems so disjointed with what we should have.
Yeah, that's right. So while that, where you've got a government that doesn't outlaw that, you've got to say they're a bit out of touch.
Yeah.
And the Tories are more likely to be out of touch in that way.
Yeah.
I think than the Labour would have been. But Labour weren't perfect by any means, and they did get voted out in 2010, I think it was, because of a lot of problems. They'd done different things that weren't popular, but maybe they were the devil you know at that time. Or is it just the usual thing you expect, swinging back and forth between two, you know, there's a slightly more reactionary version and a slightly more liberal version, and you go back and forward, and obviously it's dramatic when the election happens, but how will it look in a year or two? We may just think it wasn't a big deal, it's just similar.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it's probably, I think we're probably just going to get more of the same, really, in the UK. But it just is more of the same, which benefits some but not others. But I guess that's just the way it is. Yeah. It's just how politics works. But yeah, it's at the end of the day, it's probably not even a particularly surprising result. It's just a, I think perhaps one.
That's what you're expecting.
Yeah,
isn't it? I mean.
One perspective
I got. If you pop a balloon and you never think balloons make a noise, you'll jump when it's a bang. But if you think it's going to happen, you know, it's only because we didn't expect it, perhaps. But maybe it's not that surprising, really, if you really look at everything. And the way, you know, there was a coalition that was basically a Tory government, really. Then with the Lib Dems dropping out and this SNP were coming in at another angle, you know, there's certainly going to be a sense of, well, this is the chessboard. What's the next move? Well, if you don't want to have, you know, the S&P ruling things, you're going to have to tactically vote in some way. Whether anyone set this up to be this deliberately or whether it's just the way things have gone, I don't know. Could all be a charade from the start, but it's certainly disempowering in terms of the proportionality, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say one perspective I got was just that there was... people were beginning to suspect that we were going to have a bit more of a chance for a hung parliament where there may have needed to be some serious debate going on between the various parties to come to some sort of arrangement. And in that space, maybe Labour would have gained a bit more power and maybe even UKIP would have got a bit more sway. But no, there's none of that, really. It's just much of the same.
Mm.
And there you go. And let's just hope that now Cameron's got more power and the Conservatives have got more power and Michael Gove and that are going to start hacking at the Human Rights Act and all this business. We don't end up in a country that becomes intolerable for us.
That Human Rights Act was only passed in 1998. I mean, they will have another version of it, but.
It probably does need to be looked at, the Human Rights Act. There's a lot about it that I think is probably flawed, but yeah, it depends what they do with it, really. So yeah, I guess that's probably a good time to wrap it up. There you go. That's, I think, really, we both seem to be on the same wavelength. I think the idea really, we're just chewing it over, really, and we're just hoping for the best for the country and for us as in our current situation. And yeah, I was a little bit disappointed, but I've had time to sort of absorb the result. And yeah, maybe, you know, maybe in some sort of economy and stuff, it may end up being good for the country to have a stable government that seems to know what they're doing in terms of keeping the books in shape, as they say. But yeah, we perhaps just didn't quite get the result that would have been nice to see, perhaps. But yeah, it's all perspective, I guess, and I guess that's a good place to leave it.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.